This is NBC Nightly News, Wednesday, September 26th. Reported by John Chancellor with David Brinkley's Journal.
Good evening. Vice President Agnew's request that the House of Representatives investigate allegations that he was involved in an illegal kickback scheme was rejected today by the Democratic leadership of the House. Speaker Carl Albert said the Agnew matter is before the courts and that the House will take no action at this time. But Republican members did introduce three bills calling for a House investigation. The future of those bills is uncertain. There was also what appears to be disagreement between the Vice President and the White House about whether Mr. Agnew talked about resigning when he met with the President yesterday. Agnew says it didn't come up, but the White House says it did. It was no surprise that the House Democrats rejected Agnew's request for an investigation. He would like to prevent a grand jury in Baltimore from hearing evidence about him this week, but the House Democrats are not interested in helping him by taking over his case. Here are more reports on the Agnew story.
The Democrats broke their silence this morning and began lining up against any Agnew inquiry by Congress. They said the case should be left to the courts and suggested the vice president was only seeking to delay the grand jury investigation.
Obviously desperate to avoid prosecution, and I don't think that we should be letting him call the tune in the House of Representatives and buttress that the specious argument that he can't be prosecuted. No man's above the law in this country, and that includes vice presidents.
The country is entitled to the trial and conviction of a high public official if, in fact, he has committed a crime.
Here's a Republican vice president saying, I can't get a fair shake from a Republican attorney general. I can't get a fair trial in my home state of Maryland by a jury and a court up there. And so let's turn it over to a non-political body, the House, the Democratic House of Representatives. This is ridiculous.
After talking things over with leading Democrats, Speaker Carl Albert ruled out any House investigation, despite Republican promises to keep pushing for one.
The vice president's letter relates to matters before the courts. In view of that fact, I will not take any action on the letter at this time.
We have 192 members, and the Democrats have 243, and if they don't want to give the vice president a fair hearing, which they apparently are not going to do, there's nothing we can do about it.
House Democrats see this as more a matter of legal maneuvering and politics than fairness, and they see no reason to take the vice president off the hook. So, unless the Democrats change their stand, which seems unlikely, Mr. Agnew may just have to take his chances with a grand jury. Paul Duke, NBC News, at the Capitol.
Shortly after Speaker Albert's decision, Mr. Agnew went to the Capitol for lunch with a group of Republican senators. He told reporters he has not discussed resigning with President Nixon, he will not resign, and he did not start the negotiations with the Justice Department for an out-of-court settlement.
Comment on the matter at this time.
Mr. Vice President, can I ask you, the White House says that you and the President have discussed the possibility of your resigning, that he didn't encourage you or discourage you. Can you tell us about that discussion, how it came up and why?
The President and I have not discussed that possibility, as I think he said on several occasions, and I've also said, and I want to make very clear, I'm not thinking about resigning.
Mr. Vice President, can you comment on these plea bargaining reports?
I'll make this comment on plea bargaining. At no time have either I or my attorneys initiated any plea bargaining,
but there were Mr. Agnew's office said he is disappointed that Speaker Albert rejected his request for a House investigation. Mr. Agnew's office said he is grateful that the decision at least was quick, and he feels the decision might be reconsidered later. The vice president was said to feel that some Democrats who opposed the investigation were motivated by politics.
Meanwhile, Mr. Agnew's lawyers did not file a legal motion today to stop the Baltimore grand jury as they had been expected to. The lawyers would not explain. They still could file the motion tomorrow. The court clerk's office opens at 8:30 in the morning, and the grand jury is not scheduled to start hearing evidence against the vice president until 10 a.m. U.S. Attorney George Beall will tell the grand jury at the beginning that he is not requesting an indictment at this time. He will tell the jury that for the moment, its job is just to investigate the charges against Mr. Agnew. Ron Nesson, NBC News, Washington. By describing the grand jury as investigative only at this point, the Justice Department undercuts the vice president's case for stopping the grand jury. Mr. Agnew's contention is that a sitting vice president cannot be indicted, and therefore that the grand jury would be wasting its time. But the Justice Department insists the complaint is premature, that no indictment is being sought against the vice president yet, and in fact that it is still quite possible that evidence obtained by the grand jury would simply be turned over to the House. Assistant Attorney General Henry Peterson, in charge of the criminal division, said he could recall no case in which a federal grand jury had been enjoined. One decision that has been made is not to summon the vice president himself to testify. That could touch off another constitutional battle, which the prosecutors would prefer to avoid. Carl Stern, NBC News at the Justice Department.
In the kind of language that is popular around Washington, the official White House position on Vice President Agnew can be called a carefully defined campaign of non-involvement. This is the answer that White House press spokesman Gerald Warren gave to nearly all questions about President Nixon's attitude toward what has happened. Quote, "It would be highly improper for the White House to inject itself into the procedure the vice president has chosen to follow." When reporters pressed Warren for a more precise answer, pointing out that surely the president must have some opinion on such momentous events within his official family, the answer did not change. Privately, White House officials are insisting that the president is not casting the vice president adrift. They say that President Nixon is only complying with Vice President Agnew's wishes to chart his own course. And Gerald Warren has denied that there is any strain in the relationship between Mr. Nixon and Mr. Agnew. Someone here has described this as a delicate situation, trying to keep the president, who has troubles enough of his own, free of the vice president's problems, and at the same time not giving the impression that the vice president is being abandoned. A delicate situation. That appears to be an understatement. Tom Brokaw, NBC News at the White House.
So, here's where we stand on the Agnew case. Tomorrow, the Justice Department will begin showing that grand jury in Baltimore evidence which could link the vice president to a political kickback scheme. The evidence could be insufficient to sustain a criminal charge, and in that case, nothing will happen. The evidence could become the basis of an indictment which would lead to a criminal trial. Or the grand jury could put together a package of evidence and send it to the House of Representatives for impeachment proceedings. Impeachment consists of the full House examining the case. If a simple majority decides that a trial be held, the trial is held in the Senate. There, all of the senators sit as judges. If two-thirds vote to convict, the official on trial is removed from office. And then, that official is liable to ordinary criminal prosecution. In other news tonight, there is something good to report for a change about beef prices. Patrick Buchanan of the White House staff testified before the Watergate Committee and talked about some of the dirty trick aspects of political campaigns. And in New York, there was a farewell salute to Willie Mays, one of baseball's greatest stars.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thanks.
Say, did you notice Margaret yesterday?
Yes, she seemed quiet.
Mm-hmm. Definitely not the old Margaret.
Hi, girls.
Margaret!
Say, who wants to go to the dress sale? I hear they have some fantastic buys.
Margaret's problem? Occasional irregularity. But look, she's back in the swing with Haley's M.O. Good tasting Haley's is a gentle, gentle blend that works. When you need a laxative, get back in the swing with Haley's M.O.
We just bought a fantastic color portable. One-button tuning, solid state, and it adjusts its own picture to changing room light automatically. It's a Magnavox. In patio light, bedroom light, kitchen light, Magnavox always gives me the right picture because it adjusts to the slightest light change. I don't touch a thing. Magnavox Videomatic Color TV. What a difference watching a Magnavox.
John Dunlop, director of the Cost of Living Council, predicted today that retail beef prices will be going down soon. He based that prediction on a sharp decline in cattle prices in recent weeks. Dunlop called the phenomenon delightful from the point of view of the consumer. But cattlemen don't feel that way at all. Rebecca Bell has that story.
In the past 6 weeks, the average price of live cattle has dropped almost one-third. This is barely the break-even point for some cattlemen, and for many others, selling now means taking a sizable loss.
You know what these cattle brought 4 weeks ago today?
How much?
They brought $58.50. And I've offered the cattle to you at $37.50. That's $12 a hundred. I don't care. This is what you wanted 4 weeks ago.
I know. That's what we know now.
Some farmers admit that part of the problem is of their own making. Some held back their cattle, hoping for higher prices when the freeze lifted. Instead, cattle prices dropped.
I did really misjudge it. And my advisor misjudged it. My banker misjudged it. So we're all in it together on misjudging it, and I'm the guy that's holding the bag when it comes to this.
At an emergency meeting of Midwest cattlemen and leaders of national farm organizations, the situation was described as a crisis in the beef industry. Among other things, the group voted to back a promotional campaign to try to convince the American housewife that beef, especially at current prices, is a bargain and that now is the time to buy. Beef may well become a bargain. Some supermarkets in Chicago have dropped beef prices by as much as 20% in the past 2 weeks, and the prices could go down another 10% next week. Even so, it may be hard to win back the consumer to beef. Consumer resistance to high prices has been so great that for the first time since the end of World War II, Americans are eating less beef. Rebecca Bell, NBC News, Chicago.
Retail gasoline prices are going up later this week. On Monday, President Nixon promised gasoline dealers relief from the wholesale price boosts they've had to absorb. Today, the Cost of Living Council said the dealers will be permitted to raise prices. The decision was made following dealer shutdowns in various parts of the country. For example, near Chicago, one service station operator shut down in protest several weeks ago and now is reopened. Bob Jameson has the story.
Rudy Iberle took over this station in suburban Chicago 4 years ago. In that time, he has more than doubled the business. Rudy, who works here 60 hours a week to support his wife and five children, closed down several weeks ago to show his anger at the Cost of Living Council. Rudy Iberle says the price freeze means he loses money on every gallon of gas he pumps here. Like other standard dealers, Rudy pays the oil company 20 and a half cents a gallon for the gas. Added to that are taxes totaling 13 cents a gallon. Between what he can charge and what he has to pay, the difference is 6.1 cents a gallon. But Rudy says his overhead is actually higher than that, more than 2 cents higher. Aggravating the situation is the rationing of gas by Standard Oil. They deliver Rudy less each month than he can sell. And like other dealers, he believes the profit lies in big volume. But Rudy places the blame for his troubles on the government.
Well, I feel getting a raw deal from the government. Something's got to break.
Do you have any alternatives?
Well, about the only thing I can see is that we start cheating, violating the law.
What Rudy Iberle and other gasoline dealers want is for the Cost of Living Council to allow them to increase their prices by 2 cents a gallon. If that doesn't happen, people like Rudy may be left with the choice of breaking the law by violating the price ceiling or going out of business. Bob Jameson, NBC News in Skokie, Illinois.
While the gasoline station dealers will get something, the Cost of Living Council did not specify whether it will be as much as 2 cents a gallon. In the meantime, the House Commerce Committee today approved legislation requiring the president to impose mandatory allocations on all petroleum products. The Senate already has passed such a bill. The stock market had a sixth straight session today of rising prices. Again, trading was heavy. The Dow Jones Industrials were up almost 9 points. On the New York Exchange, the average price of a share increased 28 cents. On the American Exchange, the average price of a share gained 12 cents. The government said today that the United States international trade balance was in the red by almost $17 million in August. Actually, that's a low figure, and the Commerce Department predicts the country's best trading year in 3 years.
Ah, cran apple for breakfast. Sweet, like apples.
I'd say tart, like cranberries.
Sweet, I'm afraid.
Actually, tart says it best.
Sweet.
Tart.
Sweet.
Tart.
Sweet tart, sweet tart, sweet tart.
Ocean Spray Cranapple. Not too sweet, not too tart, with lots of vitamin C. Ocean Spray Cranapple for breakfast. It's
sweet tart.
Uh-oh. Somebody's big weekend is not panning out. But nobody ever didn't have fun bowling. Especially weekends. Bowling with friends, with the family, making that big strike. Now that's fun. This weekend, more lanes are available just when you are. For a really big weekend, there's no way you can miss.
The Senate today voted to cut American troop strength overseas by 40%. A few hours later, it reversed itself. But in both cases, the margin was narrow and indicated a change of mood in the country. David Brinkley's journal tonight deals with that change of mood. David?
The President, the Pentagon, and most members of the House are opposed to bringing home any troops from Europe now, so they will stay where they are indefinitely. But today's first vote in the Senate did show a growing impatience that this country, 28 years after World War II, still maintains the attitudes of the Cold War, of confrontation with Russia, and still maintains the military as its biggest and most expensive enterprise, public or private. The President wants to negotiate a mutual reduction of troops in Europe. The Russians withdraw some, and we withdraw some. But even so, the Russians would withdraw only to their own borders nearby, and the U.S. would withdraw clear across the Atlantic. And so there is no way to make it truly mutual. Some of the senators voting today think the U.S. could save money by bringing some, not all, some of its forces home. If in a reasonable time the Russians did not reciprocate, the Americans could be sent back if necessary, so nothing would be lost. The stated purpose of the C-5A airplane, just bought at fantastic cost, is to move troops and weapons, even tanks, anywhere on Earth they are needed, within hours. Again, the President and the Pentagon will win this one and keep the troops there. But the first Senate vote today does suggest an impatience with carrying on and paying for policies invented a generation ago and now outdated. John?
A prime policy objective of President Nixon and Henry Kissinger, his new Secretary of State, suffered a setback today. The powerful House Ways and Means Committee voted against trade concessions to the Soviet Union unless the Soviet Union allows Russian Jews and others to leave the country when they please. Before the committee vote was taken, Kissinger held a news conference in New York. He talked about the proposed Soviet trade concessions, among other things. Richard Valeriani covered the story.
Kissinger said at his news conference that President Nixon was still planning to visit Europe in the near future. When asked about congressional opposition to giving the Soviet Union equal trade treatment, Kissinger complained that such legislation had never been used before to try to get a communist country to change its policy.
If now the most favored nations clause is blocked, then the most serious questions have to be raised about the degree to which other countries, and in this case the Soviet Union, can rely on a complex negotiation and about the performance of the United States over a period of time of its commitment. And therefore, it would certainly be a significant setback in the policy that we are pursuing.
Afterward, Kissinger conferred with West German Chancellor Willy Brandt in advance of Brandt's meeting with President Nixon this Saturday. Kissinger is flying back to Washington tomorrow, when he'll set foot in the State Department for the first time as Secretary of State. Richard Valeriani, NBC News at the United Nations.
You ate so fast. Are you sure you've had enough?
I'm sure.
Well, I'll only have to throw it out.
Throw it out.
I'll wrap it up and you can take it home.
I need some Alka-Seltzer.
When you have heartburn and headache, Alka-Seltzer relieves your headache and neutralizes all the acid your stomach has churned out.
I feel much better.
Good.
USI's round-the-clock pantyhose are made to move with you round the clock. From 9 to 5, from 5 to whenever. They're made in so many different sizes to fit perfectly all the time. If they didn't, we wouldn't put our USI name on them or on any of our products. When we say USI makes a world of difference, this is what we mean.
The Senate Watergate Committee began a new phase today in its investigation. It has passed on from the Watergate burglary and the cover-up to the subject of political dirty tricks. Presidential aide Patrick Buchanan was in the witness chair. Buchanan began by refusing to comply with a committee subpoena for some presidential staff papers, apparently on the grounds that they are private presidential papers. Buchanan also denied that memoranda he wrote on political tactics for the presidential campaign led to the dirty tricks associated with the Watergate scandal. He was questioned by the committee about his philosophy of campaign tactics.
What tactics would you be willing to use?
What tactics would I be willing to use? Anything that had been, that was not immoral, unethical, illegal, or unprecedented in previous Democratic campaigns. Now, there's a line across which political tricks should not go, quite clearly. One of them, obviously, was in Florida, the salacious attack on Senators Jackson and Senator Humphrey, which, and another, I think, was against us, against the president, when phone banks of McGovern's campaign, I believe, were used in California to get near-violent demonstrations to deny the president of the United States the right to speak. These things clearly got out of hand, and I think in both campaigns. My own view is that there are sort of four gradations. There are things that are utterly, really outrageous, and I would put that in there along with the kind of demonstrations against Vice President Humphrey in 68, which denied him an opportunity to speak for almost a month. Then there's dirty tricks, then there's political hardball, and then there's pranks. And I think you almost have to leave it to the individual and his own sense of ethics as to what is permissible, and there's no question but that the line was probably breached in both campaigns in 72 and perhaps in previous ones.
And the trouble is sometimes that's left to people's determination to have no ethics, and we have very unethical things to happen.
Yes, sir, that's very true.
Buchanan's testimony brings to an end this phase of the live television coverage of the Watergate hearings. The committee will continue to hear witnesses until around the 1st of November in the areas of campaign financing and political dirty tricks. There were a lot of fascinating disclosures during these hearings, and we have one for you tonight. E. Howard Hunt testified that he forged a State Department cable which was designed to make President John Kennedy appear responsible for the assassination of South Vietnam's Premier Ngo Dinh Diem and his brother Ngo Dinh Nu in 1963. Hunt showed the forged cable to a Life magazine reporter named William Lambert, who was properly suspicious and never used it in the story. Lambert has supplied us with the text, and it's pretty gamey stuff. It's purportedly signed by Dean Rusk and addressed to Henry Cabot Lodge and says, "At highest level meeting today, decision reluctantly made that neither you nor General Paul Harkins should intervene in behalf of Jem and New in event they seek asylum. Moreover, it says, leaders of successful coup deserve clean slate in South Vietnam, which they likely achieve by making sure neither brother survives. As we say, this is a forgery." It goes on to say to Lodge, "All of us here realize this places you in uncomfortable and distasteful position. Nevertheless, we believe future success depends upon displacement of Nu and Jem. In effect, they have brought this stage upon themselves, and their ultimate fate is now Vietnamese affair." As we say, a forgery and a crude one, easily checked. But that's part of what E. Howard Hunt was doing in the White House.
"I've got a secret in my refrigerator. It's there, way in back. See? An open box of Arm & Hammer baking soda. It actually absorbs food odors. Whether you have cheese, onions, broccoli, even fish, it'll keep your refrigerator sweeter, cleaner, and fresher smelling. At the end of 2 months, put in a new box and pour the old box down a drain to help make it clean smelling. Arm & Hammer baking soda. A nice little secret for your refrigerator."
So the clerk says I'll give you the room, but you got to take your own bath.
This man is confident loose dentures won't embarrass him when he talks, because Orafix denture adhesive holds and keeps holding to help him speak clearly. Our ingenious ingredient helps spread Orafix evenly, so you get a tight seal that holds your dentures.
Where does an 800-pound gorilla sleep? Anywhere he wants.
Orafix helps you speak clearly without embarrassment. Use Orafix, the seal of confidence.
Five people were killed in Kansas by tornadoes, which struck in that state last night and today. And there was severe flooding from thunderstorms in Nebraska and Iowa. Anna Magnani, the fine Italian actress, died of cancer today in a Rome hospital. She was 65. She came to fame in Rossellini's Open City, won an Academy Award for her performance in The Rose Tattoo. And tonight, her last movie, called 1870, was shown on Italian television. The great Willie Mays is retiring from baseball at the end of this season. Last night at Shea Stadium in New York, 50,000 people said goodbye to him, affectionately and noisily, for the better part of an hour.
Ladies and gentlemen, Willie Mays!
I love baseball, and I played it all the time, but not the way that I love it. Sad day for me. I may not look sad, but it is in my heart right now to hear you cheer for me and not be able to do anything about it.
$50,000 there last night, and there must be at least 50 million people in this country who feel the same way about Willie Mays, including us. Good night for NBC News.